It'll be about 2 years' worth. Wow. About 2 years ago is when I started recording them. Partly so I could send them to my mom and dad. I figured, you know, that at least I'd have some fans.
Did you get any ask for repeat performance?
I asked for repeat performance. Well, actually, here's the irony. We did this particular class that we're about to teach, that I'm about to teach, 6.5 years ago. Because we are now at the point where we're dealing with the genealogies that are found in Matthew and Luke.
This is for snakes.
On the ground this way.
This is for Luke.
Now, what we have here and what I just handed out are the two columns. You've got, there's plenty, there should be plenty.
Bring one more over.
One more sheet. We've got plenty. We've got 8 regular people missing today, so I actually have more copies than I anticipated. What you have on the left column is Matthew, and the right-hand column is Luke. Now, when you start talking about genealogies, you have this kind of this interesting history of our of each of us. We all have, does everybody have one, by the way? Make sure. Okay, we all got one, because we're going to be referring to it a lot. Is there any extras?
Yeah,
no,
very awesome.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because we've got one missing.
Are we going to need to hang on to these for a while, or just this morning?
Just this morning. We're going to do the whole kit and caboodle today, and then we'll move on. And if it takes us 3 hours, we'll be here all 3 hours.
Spoken like a real professor.
So I'm spoken like a professor. It's the most important class of all. Apparently, in looking in some old documents, when I was in high school, I began asking my father about some of our family history. Because I knew that one of my great-grandparents or great-great-grandparents somewhere had come over from Germany to start a church in Chicago. And he actually put together this genealogy of the Lobby family, which is really kind of cool. And let's see, we're over here. So we're this tiny little grouping right over here in the corner. Since I showed this to you many years ago, here, I'll give you one. My dad actually, before he passed away, had given me this little book. This particular little book is the Luther's Small Catechism, but it's completely written in German. And it was given to him by his dad, who was a pastor of this Lutheran church, whose father-in-law was the pastor of this Lutheran church, whose grandfather-in-law was the pastor of the Lutheran church. And if you want, I'm going to pass it around just for tickles and grins. Here's the picture of the founders of our church, not our church, the church in 1872, had come over from Germany, and a couple pages later, 3 or 4 pages later, you'll see a picture of great-granddad and then my grandfather, William Lobby, who gave German and English services every Sunday until he was 86 years old. It's an interesting heritage. You know, when you have that, my dad is pure German. His middle name is Gustav, named after his grandfather. So now you know my secret password code. Yeah, like you're going to remember. I mean, I have an aunt Brunhilde. I mean, this is very much a German family, and my dad was the first one to leave the clan, if you want to call it so to speak, and the first one to marry a non-German, which was a big deal and created a lot of tension in the family that still lasts to this day. I talked to my mom this past week because it was her 91st birthday. And we just had a nice chat. We actually even talked a little bit about this church back in Chicago. It's still there. It's in the Maywood area. There's only 11 people attending now. So most likely it will fade away as time goes by. But it made me wonder, when you think about heritage, I mean, here we have Jesus, right at the beginning of Matthew. Matthew doesn't say, "Hi, my name is Matthew and I'm going to write you an important story." No, he starts with the book, the Biblios of the Genesis of Jesus Christ. The Greek word there for genealogy is Genesis, the beginning. So he starts right off with this. Luke, in his gospel, doesn't get to the genealogies till chapter 3. And it's almost like an afterthought, because he had set up the whole story of John the Baptist coming and the expression of where all that came from. And then he goes, oh, by the way, here's a genealogy to back it all up. There's no genealogy in Mark. Probably because really, at least according to tradition, Mark is the compilation of the thoughts and the eyewitness accounts of Peter. It's really the action, the ministry of Jesus is the focus of Mark. Book of John, we looked at this last week, John 1:1-18. Genealogy is Jesus was pre-existent before all time. He was with God. He was the creator. You don't need a genealogy when you were there before it all began. It's really not the issue. He was making a philosophical statement about who Jesus was as the Logos, and to counter what some of the philosophical things were happening in that time frame. Well, when you look at these two genealogies, just as you look at them, they're very different. From Abraham to David, they're identical. From David to Jesus, they are almost completely different. But rather than have us do a reading of the genealogies, because I'm afraid you all fall asleep, I'm actually going to play a song. Aren't you thrilled? This is a guy who actually put the genealogy of Matthew to music.
Thanks.
Okay, so bear with me. This is actually really clever. So what you do is you look at your genealogy of Matthew on the left-hand column, and then you'll have the lyrics to the song.
Followed by Manasseh. Akim had Azer, who had Zadok, who had Akim. Akim was the father of Eliakim. He had Eliezer, who had Nathan, who had Jacob. Listen very closely, I don't want to sing this twice. Jacob was the father of Joseph, husband of Mary, mother of Christ.
That's pretty cool.
Isn't that great? A guy named Andrew Peterson on his album Behold the Lamb. It's a great little Christmas album. He does a lot of folk type songs envisioning the nativity, and that particular one, really clever. So, let's all sing along. I won't project the words up on the board. You have them in front of you in your hymnal. Anyway, isn't that interesting to be able to try to put it in a memorable form? I mean, you could actually learn that song and learn the genealogies. Now, an observation about genealogies. They were really important to the Jewish people. We kind of know that by looking at our Old Testament. I mean, there are 9 genealogies in Genesis. 17 chapters of the First Chronicles are devoted to genealogies. There are 9 other genealogies in Ezra and Nehemiah. There's this constant looking back of where they came from. And there's a number of reasons. You could probably guess a few of them. For one thing, their ancestry determined their claim on their land, because the land was divided up by the tribes, the 12 tribes of Israel. So if you had land in this tribe, you had land in this area. You could make that claim. Ancestry also determined the right to inheritance. We have many stories, but one of the most famous is Jacob and Esau, where Esau stole the birthright of Jacob. One stole the other one's bad stuff, yeah. Thing. Anyway, one wanted what the other one had and took it. And it was the birthright, the right to the property, to the inheritance.
3 and 4, not buried.
Yeah. It also, we find in Luke chapter 2, it was the basis for the taxation. They were called to their country, to their town, to be taxed according to the line of the family that they were in, so they all had to gather. The claim to the priesthood and the claim to royalty had to be verified. It was especially important for the priests after the exile. In Ezra chapter 2, there is the story of men who claim to be the tribe of Levi, and they couldn't prove it. And so they were not allowed to be part of the Levites. There was no record of their background. Most scholars and most tradition of history believes that there was some sort of genealogical record kept even during the exile, so that they could verify royalty, they could verify especially the priesthood, so that when they came back, they could reestablish the temple and have legitimate bloodlines running the place. Those records then were kept in the temple and updated regularly. What do they call it here in Phoenix, where you had you keep the birth records?
Record.
Just the record. County recording, something like that. So if you want to find your birth certificate, if you were born here, if you want to go down and check out something, you can go down to the court and petition and fill out the forms and get your thing. Or you can call the Mormon Church. I mean, the Mormons, we laugh about it, but the Mormons have a very big deal about the genealogies, because they go back and baptize relatives who are passed, so that all the entire family clan can be in, be sanctified. And if you want to do your own research or genealogical research of your own family or your own background, more than likely the archives are found in the Mormon Church somewhere. And those genealogical researchers will go down into those caves, which are climate controlled and nuclear tested for bombs. I mean, you can't blow them up. They're so
hopefully buried. They didn't test them too effectively.
Too effectively, yeah. But I mean, these things are buried in mountains in Utah because they're so important to them. And so that's where people find these and build these charts. That's where a lot of that is found. Not all of them, but that's where some of it is found. It's fascinating. I mean, you kind of dig into your past. I mean, I know Lisa has a famous connection.
What?
Yes, in your history, way, way back.
Well, everybody does. I mean, people are related to
us. Yes.
Like Daniel Boone?
Yeah, she's related to
Boone. But on the other hand, it's the Harrison presidents. I mean, really?
Yeah, so, related to Daniel Boone. Anybody else have a famous relative?
Johnny Appleseed and James Capel.
Yeah.
There you go, Johnny Appleseed. Very good.
And James
Capel. And James T. Polk. So we have two Harrisons.
Two
presidents.
Two.
Yeah.
Minor presidents.
Yeah, minor presidents. Yeah. Yeah. What number were they?
And it's only a blood draw.
It's a blood drop, but still, there's that connection. Anybody else? Yeah?
Tyler.
President Tyler?
President Tyler.
Okay.
General Bragg of the Confederate Army. Okay. Grandmother.
That's interesting. I know my mom would have been...
Betsy Ross, too.
Oh, Betsy Ross. Okay, so daughter of the American Revolution. Then. Uh-huh. See, my mom has told me that she could be a daughter of the American Revolution, but her mom... didn't think it was important, and so never got certified. Wow. And so it was lost, because there was no way to verify it. Anybody else? Okay, it's just kind of fun when you think about these odd connections in history. So we start, again, looking at the various aspects of who Jesus was. Now remember when we were talking about Herod just last month? Herod the Great. His father was a, does anybody remember?
Edomian.
An Edomite. He was not Jewish. So even though Herod married a Jew and tried to be the leader of the Jews and was declared the king of the Jews by Rome, the Jewish people were very suspicious of him because he was not of their blood. And he tried so hard to gain their trust, but the religious faction especially rejected it. Well, let's take a look at the chart, the two pairs. Oh, before I do that, I'm going to do one more handout. That would not be good. I'm just about to hand you all of my notes. That's not smart. Okay, there we go. Yeah.
Around a little faster this way.
All right, on this list, you have again Matthew and Luke. But this time, we skip from Abraham to David. We're starting at David. And we're listing Luke's genealogy in reverse order. You follow? Because you see, Matthew, his list was from the past to the present, and Luke's list was from the present to the past. See, Luke started with Jesus and ends with Adam. Matthew starts with Abraham and ends with Jesus. So right away, you get this flip-flop on the two approaches. So what this fellow did, who put this chart together, wasn't me, I'm not going to make claim to it, he reversed the order of Luke just to make a comparison. And remember when I said that after David, there's only two names that match? And that's where you see the dot, dot, dots. This kind of comparison will cause skeptics to show up at your cubicle in your office and go, see, the New Testament is fake. It's false. these are inconsistencies and they're wrong. So blow the whole New Testament up because the genealogies don't match. My genealogy would match if I did two of them. How come they couldn't? They had the same records. So why do you think they're different? Before we get to that question, I'll let you mull on it for a while. Matthew's list satisfies a Jewish heritage. A Jewish heritage begins with Abraham because he was the father of the Jewish people. There are three groups of 14 in Matthew. So you have 14 groups. 14 names, 14 names, 14 names. Three groups of 14. Luke has 11 groups of 7. If you add Jesus at the end of it. Or you include Jesus in the list, I mean. In the Lucan list, Luke follows the Greco-Roman format, which is to go from present to past. And is focusing on the heritage going back as far as possible. And if he could have drawn up a chart, he would have. Because remember, his audience was Theophilus, a Roman or a Greek or Greco-Roman audience. From Luke, in Luke, you will notice, who is the son of David? Nathan. In Matthew, who is the son of David?
Solomon.
Interesting. So Matthew's line is a royal line, because Nathan was never king. Solomon was king. In fact, you'll find a lot of kings named in the Matthew list. In the Luke list, it goes to the next son of David. Because Nathan was third, Solomon was second. The first one died. And it follows the Nathan line, which is interesting. So the main theory, and guys, I've told you this before, but when I do my research and do my study for this class, I run over so many theories, it is overwhelming. One of the commentaries had approximately 16 pages just on the differences between Luke and Matthew and why, and what were the possible theories of why they're different. And I just sat back and went, I don't care anymore. Oh my goodness sake. I mean, it's extraordinary. But what has really kind of bubbled up to the surface and become the most commonly held way to look at the two. You'll notice on the list I just handed out, I have two black lines across the top because I blacked out two words. The one over Matthew's list is the name Joseph. And the one over the Luke list is the name Mary. In that the Joseph list follows the line and lineage of Joseph. I'm sorry, the Matthew list follows the line and lineage of Joseph. The Luke list follows the line and lineage of Mary. One of the clues to that, let's look at Luke. Take your text. Look at the first verse of the Lucan genealogy. It says, Jesus, when he began his ministry, was about 30 years of age, being the son, as was supposed, of Joseph, of Heli. Because in the Greek, starting with the phrase, the son of Heli, the son of Mathat, the son of Levi, the son of Melchi, you see that? The word the son does not exist in the Greek. That's added by the translators. It actually reads, Jesus, when he began his ministry, was about 30 years of age, being the son, as was supposed, of Joseph, of Heli, of Methet, of Levi, of Melchi, of Jenai, of Joseph, of Matthias, and on and on and on. The only time it uses the word son is with Joseph. He's making a specific statement about the lineage. But we know that Joseph was not the physical father of Jesus. Because if he was, then there wouldn't be a virgin birth. And then that whole thing kind of falls apart. So that's why you have that phrase, as was supposed. And in a case like this, the Greco-Roman never listed the female. So all of these names are male names. Whereas on the Matthew side, it's not an exact as a family tree. It actually jumps generations. It's just kind of a structure. It's a very intentional structure. As I said, there are three groups of 14 names there. So, unfortunately, I can't write here because they will be very mad at me if I erase their assignment. Actually, the students will be very excited. The teacher will be upset.
Yeah.
So, if you can see over here, you've got three groups of 14. And as one fella said, if you really want to start digging into this and looking at it from a numerology standpoint, that's six sevens. Meaning Jesus is the completion because he would be the seventh seven. And we are now the children of God, the children of Jesus. Okay, that's interesting. Could it have been that there was some intentionality to that? Because it feels very structured. There is no question that there are three sets of 14 in this listing to show the beginnings and the establishment of the kingdom itself, and then its dissolvement. It ends with Jehoiakim, and then you have the exile, and then you have the reestablishment of the people. So you have past, or you know, the beginnings, you have the middle, and you have the end. And then it comes to Jesus, the fullness of time. Isn't that interesting? This is constructed this way. One theory is that it was constructed this way so they didn't have to listen to a CD to memorize it. That they could just memorize it. It would be easy to memorize it in sets of names. So in their catechism, in their study, they could do it that way. One other guy pulled this out, and this is really kind of fascinating. I went, okay, now it's getting kind of weird. The name David in Hebrew. Remember, Hebrew doesn't have vowels, right? They're added in afterwards. So you'd have David, and in the Hebrew language, there are numbers associated with each letter. D is worth 4, the V is worth 6, and the D is worth 4, equals 14. Mm-hmm. Okay, now we're all kind of going, okay, that's just weird, that'd be great on the History Channel, but I don't see that as being very inspired. Well, yeah, we don't know. But when you have scholars and others pulling this thing apart and going, wait a minute, there's some intentionality here. When Matthew was composing this, he put these numbers, he put these names in here for a reason. What is he trying to do? What is he trying to express? Well, he's trying to express the royal line of Jesus, that Jesus was the son of David, not just the son of Joseph. This is the son of David. And David goes back to Abraham. So Jesus has this lineage. Now here's an interesting point. One guy brought this up. If the Jewish leaders, the guys who were fighting against Jesus all through the New Testament, if they wanted to discredit him and discredit his lineage, they could have just gone down to the courthouse.
That they were in charge of.
That they were in charge of. Pull out the records and said, he doesn't have a birth certificate. Oh, wait a minute. That's another story. Sorry. I thought that was funny. Especially when you think about when we first did this class, there wasn't even the election hadn't even happened in 2008. Whole world has changed seemingly in the last 6 years. But you have to discredit him, they could have just simply gone to the temple, looked at the genealogical records, and disproved his lineage, and this was never done. They never doubted that he was of the house of David, ever, not once. It would have been very easy for them to do that. So there was no question Jesus was of the line and lineage of the house of David. And yet, when you look at the Matthew account, there are a couple things that jump out. Pastor Tim did a series in December this past year for Christmas on the genealogies, which was interesting. Because we had studied it 6 years ago, then we had his 4 weeks of Advent. He did some of the ruffians of the genealogy. But let's look at some of those. Let's look at the four women who show up. Verse 3, and Judah, the father of Perez and Zerah by Tamar. Tamar, if you want to put it in your margin there, Genesis chapter 38, famous story of Tamar. Judah had found for his eldest son a wife by the name of Tamar. This man, whose name was Er, was, let's just say he was a bad guy, and God slayed him. God killed him. He was no more. So by Jewish law, Er's brother Onan becomes the husband of Tamar. He refuses to father a child with her. And so in chapter 38 verse 10, Onan is killed. The third brother comes along, he's going, I want nothing to do with this woman. I mean, you're killing off all my brothers. I mean, come on. This is a problem. But actually, the third brother was not cooperative. She really wanted a child. So she dressed up as a prostitute, disguised herself, and went to Judah and negotiated a price. And the price were a few trinkets that were pretty much like his, I think it was like a coin and his shepherd's staff and some things like that, which identified who he was. They laid together. She had a child. She then announces that her son or her child was of Judah, and Judah denied it. And then she brought out the trinkets that he had given her as payment, and he had to accept that. The twins were Perez and Zerah, which you see in verse 3. And through the line of Perez is the messianic line of Jesus Christ. So a Canaanite is mentioned by name. And how she did it is not exactly winsome.
Well, you have to remember, I mean, I know everybody knows that, but she was horrified at not following the Jewish law. Mm-hmm. And it was more than just, I want to have a child. It was, this is wrong, how it was in the law.
Yeah, she was to fulfill.
And Judah afterwards said she was the more honorable.
She did. He did. She said she was more honorable than I. That she was doing what was right. But still,
yeah.
You know, even according to the most loose definitions, what she did wasn't exactly on the up and up. The next one in the list is verse 5. And it says, and Salmon, the father of Boaz, by Rahab. Rahab is a harlot. She was a Canaanite prostitute in Jericho. She was the one who hid the spies in Jericho, and during the battle she was spared because she hung her sash or whatever it was out the window, so she was spared. Now you might say, all right, you know, she did the right thing, and so her past was expunged. No. In Hebrews chapter 11, verse 31, she is referred to as Rahab the harlot. In James chapter 2, verse 25, she is referred to as Rahab the harlot. She just wasn't called Rahab. It was very much part of the Jewish history that this woman, while she had this past, that was who she was. And yet she redeemed the whole situation by doing the right thing. And she was the great-great-grandmother of David. The third one isn't quite as nasty by action, but it's also there in verse 5. And Boaz, the father of Obed by Ruth. There's the third woman. Now, it's not that Ruth was a bad woman, but she was of what tribe? She was a Moabite. Sworn enemies of the Jews. The Moabites, the Ammonites, the Edomites, they were all fighting against the Jews constantly, and guess what? They still are. Well, there's no question. The Moabites come from the incest with the daughters of Lot in Genesis chapter 19. Each daughter had a child. One was the father of the Moabites, the other became the father of the Ammonites. And it says in Deuteronomy chapter 23, verse 3, "No Ammonite or Moabite shall enter the assembly of the Lord, none of the descendants, even to the 10th generation." That's the enmity that was between them. And yet, through the grace of God, which is an extraordinary expression, which is why we love the book of Ruth, is you have this woman that through the love of Boaz, through the kinsman redeemer, brought her in to the family. And she was the great grandmother of David. And then third, verse 6, the third woman, says, "Jesse, the father of David the king, and David was the father of Solomon by the woman who shall be unnamed." Ooh, there's no name there. The wife of Uriah. Well, we know that name as?
Bathsheba.
So we have the one who seduced David, the famous story of seduction and murder and all of that, and she's listed, but not by name. And yet, she was part of the lineage. The first child that David and Bathsheba had died in infancy. The second child was Solomon. The third child was Nathan, which we find in the Luke lineage. Isn't that interesting?
So what's that? Wasn't his first wife, right? That wasn't his first child.
No. No, he had multiple wives, as did Solomon. He had a few. Like father, like son. Anyway, no, they're again, part of the culture and whatnot was they multiple wives was not uncommon.
So I know we probably touched on this too, but all of the three, not the fourth, mm-hmm. are just amazing grace stories.
They really are.
The Uriah, I mean, the fact that it's his name, God the Holy Spirit put his name, it's not the genealogy, but he was the faithful. He was, that. It's like the stamp in the New Testament of God's love for this very, very faithful, strong man. It's just, there was probably amazing celebration in heaven when Uriah came there. Because God's eyes was very honorable, and so it just is always astounding that name, it's not just overlooking or pushing Bathsheba aside, it's just Uriah becomes mentioned in the lineage, the only one that has really nothing to do with.
Yeah, he has no bloodline, but he has.
His
yeah,
name.
His name is there.
And how important the name is in theology and Jewish tradition, mm-hmm. and just the philosophy. His name, so
I just think that's...
Yeah. Well, there are a couple things that I brought out here. Find my notes. Get this right. These genealogies, as we're mentioning a little bit, they really do show God's mercy throughout human history. There were a couple jokes that I came across. One guy said, "Yeah, I spent $500 to uncover and reveal my family history, and I spent $2,500 to hide it." I mean, not everybody has a wonderful past. In fact, there was one. I am going to find it. Where is it? It's on this page. No. Here we go. I recently heard about a very prominent family who commissioned a professional biographer to record their family tree. They gave him very careful instructions and cautioned him to deal carefully with a certain Uncle George, who, in a drunken stupor, had committed murder and was subsequently sent to the electric chair. The biographer assured them that he could handle it, and this is what he wrote. "Uncle George occupied a chair of Applied Electronics at an important government institution. He was attached to his position by the strongest of ties, and his death came as a real shock." Oh, that is just too funny. But you know, there may be people in your family or immediate family in the past, it's like, I'd really, really rather not talk about them. But you know what? God doesn't see that past. He sees you and who you are today. God uses the faithful. We see that. In fact, if you look at the Matthew list, here are some of the names. Abraham. By faith, Abraham, when God tested him, offered Isaac as a sacrifice. Isaac. He's right there. By faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau in regard to their future. Jacob. By faith, Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of Joseph's sons and worshipped as he leaned on the top of his staff. We mentioned Ruth. "Wherever you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people and your God, my God." David. "The Lord sought out a man after his own heart." Solomon. "I will do what you have asked. I will give you a wise and discerning heart so that there will never have been anyone like you, nor will there ever be." Asa, King Asa. "Asa did what was right in the eyes of the Lord as his father David had done." Jehoshaphat. "The Lord was with Jehoshaphat because in his early years he walked in the ways of his father David." Josiah. "Neither before nor after Josiah was there a king like him who turned to the Lord as he did, with all his heart, with all his soul, with all his strength, in accordance with all the law of Moses." And then Hezekiah. "Hezekiah trusted in the Lord, the God of Israel." So he uses the faithful. These are famous names. But then he also uses the failures. We mentioned Rahab. We mentioned Bathsheba. We also mentioned Tamar. But this one fella brought up Judah, the father-in-law of Tamar. He says this is really interesting. He said, "Jacob had 12 sons, but for some reason, the lineage of the Lord ran through Judah. It's very interesting because he wasn't the oldest like Reuben, nor was he the favorite like Joseph or Benjamin. And yet Genesis 49:10 states that the ruler would come out of Judah, The scepter would not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet. It's traced all the way to the end of the Bible in Revelation 5, where it says, "Then one of the elders said to me, 'Do not weep. See, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has triumphed, and he is able to open the scroll and its seven seals.'" So with even the climax of history, Judah's offspring are named. So he doesn't use the oldest as the one. It could have been, "You will be from the line and lineage of the tribe of Reuben." No, he picked Judah. A picture of grace. In verse 7 of Matthew 1, we see King Rehoboam, who was the son of Solomon. Well, Rehoboam was the one who split the kingdom. He fought his brother, and we ended up with the northern and the southern kingdoms. Not exactly someone that you would want to put on your happy list, as I'm proud to be of the lineage of Rehoboam. Ahaz is mentioned in verse 9. Ahaz worshipped pagan gods and eventually self-destructed. It was to King Ahaz that Isaiah made his prophecy of the promised Emmanuel that would be born a virgin in Isaiah chapter 7. And when he died, he was buried without honor. And then, verse 10, we have Manasseh. Manasseh reigned longer than any of the other kings. 55 years. You would think, well, you know, get some brownie points for that. But he was the most wicked ruler. He was into idolatry. He sacrificed his son to Molech. He worshipped the sun and the stars. He killed anyone who disagreed with him. And in 2 Kings 21, verse 9, it says, "Manasseh led them astray, so they did more evil than the nations the Lord had destroyed before the Israelites." And he was one of those deported to Babylon. Now granted, the rest of the story is that Manasseh repented and turned back. But at that time, he was part of the destruction of the people. And yet God has him in this lineage of Jesus. Not just the heroes. Not just the great ones. And then, what's interesting, he also uses a few forgotten ones like Hezron and Ram and Abiud and Azor and Achim and Zadok. We have no idea who these people are. They're not mentioned anywhere else. And if you go through the list of Luke, my goodness, I you know, you're lucky to recognize any of the names as ones that will jump out at you as famous. Which is one of the reasons why I asked, are you related to somebody famous? Because those are the ones that we like to talk about. We're not going to mention, you know, great-great-granddad Bob. Nobody knows who that is. And yet, he is part of that lineage. He is part of that connection. Well, here's what I wrote. I said here, our heritage is something to note. Maybe even to take pride in, or maybe even to take shame. But we are responsible for our own heritage, the one that we make today. We are not just children of our mother and father, but we have the honor to be children of God. And our lineage becomes direct from Jesus, the Son of God, the Father, and we are new creations in that. There's a story, I believe I brought it up. I'm going to find it here. Here we go. Joanne Shelter spent years in the Philippines with the Balanago people, translating the Bible into their language and trying to tell them the good news of the Savior. But it was slow going. One day, Ama, a man who had adopted her as his Balango daughter, picked up an English New Testament from her desk, opened it to the first page of Matthew, and stared at it. He could read enough English by that time to realize what he was seeing. He turned to her and said, "Do you mean this has a genealogy in it?" And she said, "Yeah, but skip over that part to get to the good stuff." Which isn't what we normally say. It doesn't really matter. His eyes were riveted to that first page. "You mean this is true?" And he struggled through the list of names. So Shelter got out some shelf paper, wrote the genealogy from Abraham to Jesus, from the ceiling down to the floor. Emma took it over to the village, explaining, "We always thought it was a rock and a banana plant that gave birth to our people. And we don't have their names written down. But look, for Jesus, all the names are written down." The Belongos loved Matthew's written genealogy, and to them it proved that the Bible was true. And Emma came to believe Christ as his Savior, became an enthusiastic evangelist, church leader, and translator, and Belongo New Testament was dedicated. He received the first copy. Genealogies can make a difference. Isn't that amazing how God can use that? So, thanks for our study. Let's close with a word of prayer, and we'll move on to our worship service. Lord, thank you for the exercise in looking at your lineage and helping us to understand how incredibly important it was to the people at that time, when the time had fully come, that you were who you said you were. I mean, we studied in John where you're the pre-existent one, the one there at the beginning of all creation, and out of you came everything. And yet on the human side, you were like us in that you were fully human. And this line in lineage fulfills that incredible prophecy that's found throughout the Old Testament, that there was going to become a branch from the tree of Jesse, from King David. Through all of this time and all of this history, you preserved your people so that in Christ Jesus, you had come to save us from our sins. Bless us as we move into our time of worship, that we think about our past, we, however, look to our future as your children and creating that heritage, that spiritual heritage, which cannot be shaken. In Jesus' name.